The Guardian. And welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Faker Others sitting in for Max Rushton, who can be found sitting in a corner, rocking back and forward after another 3-0 defeat for Cambridge. In today's pod, the Premier League's To Me To You title tussle continues. Penalties were awarded, taken away, given, not given, scored and missed. There was a relegation, a promotion, an alleged punch-up, and Joe Bennett was kissed. All that, along with a 9-goal thriller and a roaringly bad bet, makes up today's Guardian Football Weekly. Leads me nicely into introducing today's panel. Sunderland 4, Coventry 5 and Tiger Woods winning the Masters. Jonathan Wilson, how was your weekend?
I've had better. It was a better weekend when I went all the way to Buenos Aires for a game and didn't happen.
Really?
It was a bit, yeah. But we'll get through it.
Please tell the listeners about this bonkers bet you put on.
Well, I mean, the what I blame is alcohol. And 3 or 4 years ago, when Tiger Woods was a man having several back operations, I foolishly bet a mate of a mate, a man who doesn't even live in the same country as me. I had a significant bet with him that Tiger Woods would never win another major. And he did.
Nice.
I mean, on the plus side, I can now enjoy golf again. And it's the circumstances of watching it. Because in the Liverpool press room, the television is centrally controlled, so they're all showing the post-match stuff. So I ended up watching it on Kevin Kilbane's iPad while with Jim Beglin and Robbie Fowler.
Rock and roll.
Yeah.
Vishali Bardwaj, hello.
Hello.
Any bad bets this weekend?
No, I don't bet. I've never placed a bet in my entire life.
Very wise.
Yeah,
very,
I had a pretty good weekend.
Excellent. Barry Glendenning, over-caffeinated.
Yes, hello. Three mugs of coffee this morning, which is one too many, and I'd probably talk very fast, which will make a pleasant change.
Well, I'm looking forward to this. Right, only one place to start. Liverpool 2, Chelsea 0, the title race. Liverpool back above Manchester City. Earlier in the day, City had beaten Crystal Palace, of course. Jonathan Wilson, you were at Anfield. Was that Salah goal as beautiful live on the telly box as it was?
Yes, it was. And the great thing about it was that from the press box, you're right behind the line of the shot. So it's, you knew as soon as it left his foot that it was flying in. I mean, that sort of 3 minutes between the two goals, the noise hadn't quite subsided and it reached new levels when Salah scored. And Liverpool actually did their best to mess it up in the sort of 5 minutes after that. That Hazard, those two chances, he hit the post with the first, didn't really connect with the second. But it didn't really matter. He still sort of, as soon as that second goal went in, you thought, right, that's it, it's done, it's over.
What was that yoga tree pose celebration all about? He didn't just do it once either. He did it once, he got mobbed, and then he clearly thought, no one's seen this enough, I must do this again. What was all that about, Charlie?
I don't know. I felt like it was a message of peace off the back of, obviously, that video that emerged from the Chelsea fans, obviously, abusing him in midweek. I just felt it perhaps was a message of peace. It might just be he wanted to do it and he just liked the pose and wanted to kind of put that out there, but that's how I took it. It was interesting. I don't think anyone asked him after the game as well about that, so I'd be intrigued to see what he has to say about that celebration.
Yeah, that's really interesting. As a reminder to people, Chelsea beat Slavia Prague on Thursday in the Europa League, that Marcus Alonso late goal. But before the game, a video was posted on social media depicting several Chelsea fans chanting that racist song about Mohamed Salah. Six of the fans in the video, though, immediately identified by Chelsea, three prevented from entering the stadium, and Chelsea intend to ban all six from attending their matches. They mentioned in a statement, Chelsea finds all forms of discriminatory behaviour abhorrent, and where there's clear evidence of Chelsea season ticket holders or members involved in such behaviour, we will take the strongest possible action against them. Such individuals are an embarrassment to the vast majority of Chelsea supporters who won't tolerate them in their club. Pretty strong words, swift action from the club as well, which is pretty encouraging, right?
Absolutely. And I think Annie Robertson was asked about Mohamed Salah scoring, of course, against his former club off the back of what happened in midweek. And he said that's the best way for him to respond to chance like that is to score goals. And, you know, he mentioned Raheem Sterling's example as well and said, unfortunately, this is something that's happening quite a lot this season in particular. And the only way for these footballers to respond is to score goals and to keep on doing what they're doing, which is what Salah did yesterday.
Yeah, he did. He told Sky Sports after the game as well, I'm a yoga man. I do yoga. Just came to my mind. I don't think, I just feel. Well, both managers saying that their sides have to win all their remaining games if they want to win the title. Klopp says Liverpool expects City to win all of theirs. City have a game in hand. So according to Klopp, Barry, City are going to be the winners.
Well, we'll see. As City seem on paper certainly have a more difficult run in. They have to play Tottenham and Manchester United. They could drop points there. I mean, if Jurgen Klopp is correct, Liverpool could get 97 points and not win the title, which would just be, incredible. So unfortunate. But the way City are playing, it's difficult to see anyone beating them. But, you know, they lost against Tottenham in the Champions League last week. That's a game they could afford to lose. I had a feeling they wouldn't win all three against Tottenham. The three they have coming up, or had coming up, two left, obviously. But who's going to blink first? Will either of them blink? I don't know, but it really is fascinating.
If they keep on not blinking, they would meet in Madrid in the Champions League final as well, wouldn't they? Which would be fascinating.
That would be fantastic. Klopp said after the game, we only try to collect as many points as possible. What is it now? 85, four games to play, 97, let's try. And if that's enough, then perfect. If not, we can't change it. Very smart people will come out and say, yeah, if you'd have won against Leicester, you'd be champions. It's all bullshit. People and idiots bring something like this up. Is it all bullshit?
Well, it is true that if they had beaten Leicester and then won the remaining games of the season, they would win the league. But, I mean, you know, he's right to the extent that it's very hard to pinpoint one game and say that's where it was lost. I mean, the moment I think I would look to, if you want to highlight one moment, is the 11.7 millimetres that cost them a goal against City in early January. But then you could turn around and say, well, the missed penalty from Riyad Mahrez at Anfield. If that had gone in, they wouldn't even be close now. So,
and they have been quite lucky. I mean, not to take away from their terrific play, but several opposition goalkeepers have been extremely benevolent at the late stages of various games that have got them points they otherwise might not have, goalkeeping errors. I have a friend in Ireland who's adamant that if Liverpool don't win this league, it would go down as a choke or a bottle job, because they were 8 points clear at one point, and now you know, that deficit has been reduced to one with a, or that lead has been reduced to one with a game extra played.
It's a fair enough point. With Chelsea, Vishali, they sat pretty deep in the first half of this game. Two chances for Eden Hazard. He's got a superb record against Liverpool. Just not his day, though, was it?
No. And especially off the back of that game and that performance against West Ham, you would have thought that he would have taken those chances. And he's got a really good record at Anfield. I think it is before the yesterday's game, he'd scored in four of his last seven visits to Anfield as well. But, you know, he hit the post. That was the one that I thought he should really have scored. But the second one, you know, Alisson's saved it. He didn't get a good enough contact on it, did he, Hazard? And that was a moment where Chelsea really should have gotten back into the game. That was when Liverpool had switched off for a few minutes. Those were the chances. And then, of course, Klopp responded by bringing on Wijnaldum and Milner. And then, you know, that just completely snuffed out Chelsea's attack in that game. Chelsea, yeah, they've been interesting on the road. They seem to have a mentality shift between the first half and the second half in a lot of games away from Stamford Bridge. We saw against Everton, they were really good in that first half. And then they just completely switched off in the second half. And then, of course, they lost. And the same thing I felt against Liverpool. I thought in the first half, they didn't create the better of the chances, but they were, you know, sort of composed or really well organised. And the second half, they switch off for a couple of minutes. Liverpool make them pay for it. And then it's an uphill battle for them after that. So they've got a mentality problem away from Stamford Bridge this season. And yeah, I just felt that when Sarri then made the changes, brought on Higuain, he was just too immobile for me. I thought Giroud would have been a better option. Then you think as well, you know, if Hazard had started that game on the left, sort of the chances that he created, they were coming off the back of him kind of cutting in from the left and, you know, starting centrally. He has been effective at times when he's been played in that role, but I just think he's better from the left. And, you know, I just think it wasn't their day in the end because they switched off in the second half.
Not Chelsea's day, but Liverpool's, Jonathan. In a piece published today, you praised Jordan Henderson, saying that he's thriving in a more advanced role. Man of the match yesterday. How much has he improved over the course of the season?
I'm not sure it's a question of improving. It's just that I think when he was playing at the back of midfield, is what Klopp calls the number six role, so you know, of the three midfielders, the central and deepest of them, I don't think that's Henderson's natural game. I don't think it ever has been. I think because he's somebody who is simultaneously humble but also believes in himself, he's prepared to go, right, it's not natural to me, but I'm good enough to do it, and we'll see. And I think he doesn't have the instinctive positional awareness to be absolutely top level doing that. I think last season he was able to get away with it because of the way they pressed. The energy was more important than the tactical and positional sense. This season, as it become more conservative, he has been exposed at times. There was a lot of frustration among Liverpool fans with Henderson. I think he himself was frustrated. The game at Old Trafford in February, when he was substituted and sort of brushed off Klopp as he walked off, he ended up getting dropped. But then said, "Well, why don't I play on the right? That's actually what's natural to me." And he came on against Southampton, playing that side, that role on the right of the three, and changed the game when it was 1-1. You know, to call it an assist for the first goal is technically true, but maybe being slightly generous, given as a header out of defence that Salah then ran 80 yards and scored. The Porto game, he set up the first goal with a brilliant three ball, and then it was, you know, his sort of awareness in the box and deft chipped cross that brought the opener yesterday. So Henderson suddenly is the man who sees in games and yanking them Liverpool's way.
But then how important is it that Jurgen Klopp listened to him when he said...
Yeah, and that shows a good relationship between player and manager and the sort of... I think Henderson's gone about it in the right way. You know, he's neither sort of just put his head down and sulked, nor is he... he's been prepared to say, look, this is where I think I'd be better. Is it possible? And it's working for both of them. So they both deserve credit, yeah.
So just quickly, Liverpool also 2-0 on Porto going into their second leg of the Champions League quarter-final. Should be pretty easy from there. And also, of course, today is the 30th anniversary of Hillsborough. A minute's silence impeccably observed yesterday.
Yeah, I think maybe the most silent minute's silence I've ever heard. And somehow sort of made more poignant by the fact that the wind was sort of howling over the Anfield Road end, which I think actually affected the first half. But the Liverpool fans in the Kennydog Leash stand on the Kop all holding cards above their heads, and so the wind whipping across them, you could hear that fluttering, which I think tells you just how silent it was. And you know, the other thing you notice when you go past the Hillsborough Memorial, particularly on the anniversaries, is there's still... you know, a huge number of scarves from different clubs. So I noticed when Chelsea were laying the wreath, there was a Plymouth scarf. It was the one in the middle, but it's still a sort of a point of solidarity among fans.
Very much so. Before the game as well, of course, there was a lot of talk about it being 5 years almost to the day since that Steven Gerrard slip cost Liverpool the title against Chelsea. There were actually two other games that day back in 2014. And producer Jonathan bizarrely found out one of them was between Crystal Palace versus Manchester City, which leads me very nicely onto Crystal Palace 1, Manchester City 3. Two Raheem Sterling goals. Milivojevic made it nervy times for City in the last 9 minutes, but Gabriel Jesus popped up and made it 3-1. City 72% possession. They went back to the summit after winning the early kickoff. Obviously, Liverpool then went back again. The Premier League lead has changed 25 times this season, and I am reliably informed that that's the second highest number in a season since World War II. Two goals for Sterling, Barry. That's 10 in his last 10 for club and country. I know we've discussed this before, but how impressed have you been with him this season?
Been very impressed. I must say, before I get on to Sterling, this game did nothing to change my view that teams try harder against Liverpool than they do against City, because Palace barely laid a glove on them at all. Sterling was super impressive yesterday. He missed one chance you would expect him to score in his sleep, and it was classic City getting around the back, the pull back, and he slotted it inches wide. Pep Guardiola could barely believe his eyes. I was quite shocked he missed as well. But the other two finishes were superb. He's a wonderful player. He could still, finish ahead of Aguero in the scoring charts. And just the way he's developed as a player and as a human being are so impressive in this season. You know, when he left, I think Liverpool let him go. And that could be looked upon as a folly, I suppose, with the benefit of hindsight. But he wasn't scoring goals as prolifically for them as he is now. And clearly he's got good coaching and he's willing and eager to learn.
He's matured, hasn't he?
In every way.
Palace, though, have been pretty bad at home this season. The stats show 39 points they have right now, but only 16 of them were won at home. They've got the lowest proportion of points won at home in the entire league. Selhurst Park used to be a bit of a fortress.
Yeah, but I think there's... I think those stats... I'm not denying that they're true. They clearly are true. But I think they're slightly misleading. If the Benteke factor has skewed that massively. Lars was saying on Thursday, wasn't he, that... Palace had more shots from inside the box at home than any other team apart from City this season, which they're just not taking chances. I think they're actually playing all right at home. They're just not, for some reason, maybe the type of chance they create away from home on the break, they find easier to take than the chance they're creating at home. But I sort of suspect if I had a top class finisher who actually did something outside the box, which that's why he doesn't, then they'd actually be top half probably this season.
Burnley 2, Cardiff City 0 from the title race to the battle at the bottom. It's now 3 wins in a row for Burnley. They took a massive opportunity. It has been mentioned before, but the last 4 games are Chelsea, Manchester City, Everton and Arsenal. So they needed to pick up some points ahead of that. They've now beaten Wolves, Bournemouth and now Cardiff, who obviously still occupy that final relegation place. That's top 6 form since the turn of the year, apparently, Jonathan Wilson. So are Burnley going to survive? And do they and Mr. Dyche deserve to?
Yes and yes. Yeah, I mean, I think we obsess about when points are picked up. Burnley got 39 points. Yeah, that's good enough to stay up. Therefore, they deserve to stay up. You wonder whether they were, early in the season, they were disrupted by playing in the Europa League. I don't understand why that should be such a big deal as it seems to be for teams, but it does seem to disrupt sides. I don't know why you can't just sort of treat that as being pre-season games. Because, they were out of the tournament before. It was going to really put pressure on them in terms of workload. I saw a stat, was 6th or 7th since December 28th? So, yeah, top 6 form from the turn of the year. They may lose the last 4 games of the season. I suspect Everton will be acquiescent, as Everton often are. They're 11 points clear of Cardiff, so I mean they're safe.
Cardiff still 5 points from safety, 5 games left.
I thought Cardiff were quite unlucky in this game. I don't like going on about refereeing decisions, but they could realistically have had 3 penalties, none were given. But then Burnley's opener, Chris Wood, scoring with a header from a corner, that would have just driven Neil Warnock to madness, and I pity whoever it was that let Wood go.
Well, also, Essage, somebody getting a header, 5 yards from goal, 4 yards from goal?
Yeah.
There's very few occasions, and this wasn't one of them, where the ball's in the 6-yard box from a corner and the keeper shouldn't come for it.
Barca Jim asked a Cardiff on the wrong end of decisions simply because it's hilarious to watch Warnock absolutely losing it.
Well, he does go a bit mad with the fourth official, but I thought I keep expecting him to erupt and he doesn't this season. So, he has been... I thought he had... every right to feel very hard done by on Saturday. And I thought he would get a lot more angry than he did. But they... Yeah. they do look doomed. If they don't beat Brighton in their next game, you would imagine that jig is very much up for them.
That game is going to be absolutely massive. It was interesting to watch Neil Warnock post-match, actually, because sometimes he can be very passive-aggressive when answering questions about decisions, and he just didn't seem to be after this. He just said, let's just say I'm lost for words.
Maybe he was spent after all this fury from the Chelsea game. But, I mean, Cardiff have benefited from a penalty that was given and then ungiven against Huddersfield this season, so maybe that one has evened itself out.
Well, sometimes they do, but you know, you can understand why perhaps Warnock was disappointed about that one in particular. Cardiff haven't won since February. 2-1 win over Southampton as well. It's a long time. Let's talk about that really random Ashley Barnes double nose kiss. Have you ever seen anything like that, Charlie?
Not quite like that, but it was one of the sort of funnier, lighthearted moments, I thought. Slightly awkward at a time, but I was talking to Jonathan, the producer, actually on the way up, and I just thought, you know, love, not hate. And it just kind of released a tension, didn't it, during that sort of really nervy moment.
Do you think so?
If somebody I'm not does, sure really, Joe Bennett really, would agree.
I know. If I was Joe Bennett, I wouldn't have been overly impressed by that. Barry?
Yeah, I thought it was quite funny. Other people might think it was possibly a little sinister. I don't know, but, you know, there doesn't seem to be any major beef between the pair of them.
So that game has set up Brighton's match against Cardiff on Tuesday quite perfectly, because Brighton were absolutely hammered 5-0 by Bournemouth. I mean, it was Bournemouth's biggest win of the season. Chris Hughton described it as one of the worst performances since he took over. The defending for the first goal in particular was atrocious. Both centre-backs sprinting to block the shot from Callum Wilson. Dan Gosling by himself between the penalty spot and the six-yard box. Finished it pretty easily. We're talking about fortresses with Selhurst Park, but the Amex used to be a fortress and isn't anymore, Barry.
Well, it was an extraordinarily bad performance from Brighton against a team who had only won one of their previous 12 away from home, and that was against Huddersfield. So if I'd been doing a coupon on Saturday, I'd have had Brighton down as bankers, and Jonathan wouldn't have been the only one to have an unsuccessful weekend's gambling. But there were times Bournemouth were just walking the ball in to the net, basically. And on their day, they can be irresistible. We know that. But for Brighton to lose by that much in such horrendous fashion at home at such a key point of the season, when they're very much still in trouble, is remarkable. If I was Chris Hughton, I think I'd nearly be inclined to just chalk it up as one of those days and not dwell on it too much and just focus on the game against Cardiff instead.
Well, I think that's the only thing he can do.
I mean, Lewis Dunk and Shane Duffy are quite a good central defensive partnership, you know, for a team that's mid to lower end of the Premier League, but they were dreadful, both of them, in that game, uncharacteristically dreadful. I would be surprised if Brighton played anywhere near that bad again against Cardiff.
Yeah, it's certainly an incentive to put in a performance against Cardiff, which is exactly what Chris Hughton said post-match as well. But Anthony Knockhart's red card in that situation, they're 2-0 down, they're in a relegation battle. It was absolutely idiotic, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, one of the few refereeing decisions that you can't doubt. But I guess it sort of makes some kind of sense, though, right? That you're very frustrated and you're expressing it in a incredibly self-destructive way. So I don't know. Does it show he cares?
I think he wanted to be seen to be caring, but you know, getting yourself sent off when your team's 2-0 down is not the best way to go about it.
And that's the sort of foul you wonder whether there should be some provision to get more than a 3-game ban for, because it's just a horrendous foul. It's not nowhere near the ball. Yeah, there's not much. Yeah, there's no difference between that and just punching somebody in the face, right?
I'm not sure his teammates would agree that it showed he cared, because he's now got a minimum 3-game ban. They've got massive games coming up. We mentioned Cardiff already. They've got Wolves as well. Now, he was joint top scorer the year that they came up from the Championship. 15 goals, tied with Glenn Murray. He's got just 5 goals in their 2 Premier League campaigns since then. Is there an argument that he could be out of his depth at this level?
Possibly. I mean, he hasn't even been starting every single game for Brighton. I remember that season when they came up, I watched a lot of the Brighton games. He was a regular starter and, he repaid Chris Hughton's faith in him by scoring plenty of goals. He's struggled in the Premier League, I think that's safe to say. He hasn't been able to win that and keep that starting spot. And obviously moments like we saw against Bournemouth, I mean, you can't even think what was going through his head. I think nothing was going through his head when he made that challenge, and Chris Hughton was absolutely fuming. He didn't even look at him, did he, as he walked down the tunnel. Yeah, it was a poor moment from him. And it came, I think it was in the 60th minute, wasn't it? It was between 58th, the 60th. 58th, yeah. So to do that, you know, with a good half an hour left on the clock, I mean, I know they were losing and they were losing quite badly.
68, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I just thought, couldn't believe he had done that. But yeah, a really poor game from Brighton. You just wonder as well, I mean, how their run in the FA Cup has affected them, because they were really resilient and they only lost 1-0 to City, didn't they, at Wembley. But to then, play a game at home against a Bournemouth side who got such a poor away record, who conceded so many goals, and to lose their composure, their discipline, it seemed like they were nervous from the start. I think that's what I think it looked like to me. And once the first sort of one or two goals went in, they just completely lost it. And yeah, I think Barry's right. You can think that maybe Chris Hughton should be putting it down to just a bad day in the office, because that's not what he probably would have seen on the training pitches during the week.
They've had a lot of those bad days recently. That's the problem, isn't it? Not as bad as that, but they've won 3 of the last 19 in the Premier League. Yeah, they were 10th when they went 10th by beating Palace on the 4th of December. Since when they've only won 3 times. So,
sorry, just going back to Anthony Knockhart, the one thing I would say in mitigation for him is that since Brighton have come up, I think he's had a lot of stuff going on in his personal life. His marriage is broken up. I think it was quite acrimonious, and his dad died. He was very close to his dad. So while, you do have to get on with life and go about your work, you wouldn't be human, really, if you're enduring those kind of traumas and it's not affecting you.
Yeah, fair point. Much as Brighton were bad, Bournemouth were pretty good. And when you think about Fraser and Callum Wilson, that pairing for Bournemouth has been the best in the league. 11 goals when they've combined to score. Can Bournemouth keep hold of them in the summer?
Well, that's always a worry. I guess David Brook falls in the same category. That his return from injury seems to have coincided with Bournemouth's slight upturn in form. So, but that's what being Bournemouth is, isn't it? You develop good players and then you're terrified of losing them.
I don't think they'll hold on to Ryan Fraser, certainly. He's been heavily linked with a move to Arsenal, and he's even addressed the fact that he thinks it may have been causing him a bit of a distraction. And Callum Wilson, there was talk that he might go to Chelsea in last January, so it might struggle to hold on to him too.
So Brighton versus Cardiff on Tuesday becomes absolutely massive. Chris Hughton saying that they have to win it for their fans after that performance. Tim van der Laan is asking, should the Premier League have relegation playoffs? Would love to see Cardiff and Brighton at Wembley in an epic battle to finally decide who is slightly less bad.
Speaking as a fan of a team who was relegated in a relegation playoff in 1987, No, they're horrible. Like, the playoffs should be aspirational and fun. It's something really grim, especially when you get relegated on away goals after extra time from an own goal. Which, being Sunderland, we did tick all 3 of those boxes.
Wow. That's it for part one. We'll round up the rest of the Premier League action in part two and talk relegations and promotions in the Football League, as well as the Women's FA Cup semi-finals.
It's time to focus.
The mood in the UK right now, it seems to me, is a huge set of tensions and contradictions and emotions and feelings about our past, and we're not thinking very much about the future.
Today in Focus is the new daily podcast from The Guardian. Join me, Anushka Astana, for the best stories from our journalists around the world. Subscribe now to Today in Focus from The Guardian.
Welcome to part two. Buy stuff from us. Still a few tickets left for our live shows next week, 22nd of April at SWG3 in Glasgow. Max, Barry, Ewan Murray and you, Jonathan Wilson. And on the 23rd of April at the Elmwood Hall in Belfast, Max, Barry, Ewan Murray and Lars Sivertsen. And a newly announced show as well. I've just been, I was so excited about saying Earth. Max always says it so excitedly. Earth, the 10th of May in Hackney. Max, Barry, Jonathan Wilson and Lars Sivertsen. What a lineup.
I'm looking forward to one in Glasgow when Ewan Murray will be able to give a first-hand account of Tiger Woods' magnificent major victory or Masters victory, assuming he gets back in one piece.
Yeah, that'll be fun.
Yeah.
Why are your arms crossed, Jonathan?
It's a defensive posture that... Christian Benteke, how finished do you think he is? Do you think he'll ever score another Premier League hat-trick? And would you like to offer me odds of 5-1 that he never will?
No.
You've learned well.
Manchester United 2, West Ham 1, 2 Paul Pogba penalties, giving all the points to Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. Perhaps one of those games that if Jose Mourinho had still been in charge, United would have lost. They seem to have the Ole Gunnar Solskjaer fairy dust luck with this game. He admitted afterwards as much that they pretty much got away with it. Without the Fergie time, was this old school jammy United, Vishali?
Absolutely, and he'll be taking all the luck that he can get, because he admitted after the game they were lucky to get all 3 points. I mean, that wasn't a penalty. I didn't think the first one was it was offside, wasn't it, for the foul and the build up to the second. And they were very lucky. It was a very, very good West Ham performance. And another day, they surely would have walked away with all 3 points. I mean, they beat them in the reverse fixture, didn't they? And West Ham, I know they had lost to Chelsea in the game before that, but they're looking much more steady now under Manuel Pellegrini. They've had a lot of players return from injury now. They're much better defensively and they create a lot of chances, and they are scoring more goals now. So, you know, they are locked in that battle for seventh place finish. I don't think they'll make seventh place. I mean, Pablo Zabaleta said a couple of weeks ago, he said, we just don't have the mentality to do it now. I think a lot of players are looking ahead to the summer break now. But, you know, they were very, very unlucky. But I think the thing about Manchester United was they kept on going. It wasn't the easiest of games for them, but they kept on going. And they ended with the 3 points, and it's huge for them in the top four race.
Yeah, West Ham had more of the ball, 58%, more shots as well. Felipe Anderson, though, with his first goal of 2019, 9 for the season now. He looked to be back at his best, Barry, but frustratingly inconsistent, isn't he?
Yeah, and that seems to be a problem with quite a lot of West Ham players individually and them as a collective. I mean,
but that's why they play for West Ham, right?
I suppose. I mean,
they're talented players, and if they're consistent with it, they play for better teams. So,
yeah,
I think Everton are the same. Everton are incredibly inconsistent for the same reason.
Well, like Everton looked like world beaters when they absolutely hammered West Ham 3-0 a couple of weeks ago, and could have been a lot more. And then West Ham, really unfortunate to lose this game. I mean, that Felipe Anderson goal should have stood. Michael Antonio spanked one off the bar, and then when it was 1-1, Ryan Fredericks dives in with this absolutely gormless challenge to give away a penalty. He'd just come on, I think it was possibly his first contribution of any kind.
I think it was. I think he'd been on the pitch for about 3 minutes. I mean, that's not something you can blame tiredness or anything else apart from
just... But, you know, it doesn't really matter to West Ham whether they win or not. They can take heart from a good performance. It's not going to make any difference to their season or anything, so... But yeah, United were lucky, and I think if United had lost that game, which they deserved to, might be a few questions. You know, possible. Did they give Ollie the job a bit too quickly?
Well, there's a piece in the Independent this morning suggesting that Ollie's not happy with the fitness of the team, and sort of blaming Mourinho for that, which is what I would say in his position. But it might also be true. It certainly would explain why there was that, the first 2 months under Solskjaer, there was that lift, and that now they're struggling to sustain it if fitness and conditioning is a problem for them.
Two penalties, though. Nobody ever wants to go and step up and take the second one, having scored the first, but Pogba managed to do it, Vishali.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's a lot of questions about Pogba in recent weeks about whether or not he's fully focused on United, given that he's been linked to, you know, a move away this summer. But he stepped up and he scored those two goals. And that was the key thing for him, was just to convert the chances that he then got from the spot to get all 3 points. So, you know, he's showing that he's focused on the job at hand at the moment, and they're going to need all their players fully focused, because it's a really, really tight top four race. It's great for the neutral just to watch it unfold, because Arsenal could come back into the top four if they beat Watford. You know, Spurs are looking good again. They've got the sort of the lift of the new stadium. United are starting to wobble. Arsenal got that poor away record, but then they've got so many games still to come away from home. So it's going to be interesting.
Did you see that the weird story that he's refusing to park in the gaffer's parking space because it's Fergie's space? How weird's that?
It is really weird. I mean, it's not quite, yeah, somebody, I don't know, keeping their, you know, it's not quite psycho. So, you know, keeping your mother's body in the rocking chair, but it's not a million miles away. And like, how far do you go with that? Kind of, you know, you can't park there. That's Giggsy's space. You can't park there. That's Beckham's space.
Oh, I don't want this office. That was his office.
He got a different chair or something.
And then, yeah, but this goes on for kind of, yeah, 10, 20 years. The new signing gets, say, 20 minutes late for training on his first day. Where have you been? Well, your parking space is 3.5 miles, kind of. So, I don't know. I think, I mean, I wrote a piece last week about the dangers of being too obsessed by your mentor, and how you have to, you know, sort of this almost an Oedipal relationship there. You have to sort of kill your spiritual footballing father. And I think Ollie's got to the point where he really needs to get on and do that.
Now, before we look forward to the game against Barcelona, there was also a video circulated of what appeared to be West Ham supporters on a tram in Manchester singing anti-Semitic songs. The club has responded. We're taking immediate action to try to identify the offenders, whose details we'll be handing over to the police, and will be banned for life from the London Stadium and from travelling with the club. It might be appropriate as well at this point to point you towards Jacob Steinberg's excellent reporting, particularly the long read published last week entitled From Parks to Premier League, The Shocking Scale of Racism in English Football, which is an in-depth investigation and important reading worth a look.
I went to the Imperial War Museum on Friday. Was at a loose end, and the Holocaust exhibition on the fourth floor there. I would suggest those West Ham fans and any others found guilty of anti-Semitic abuse be made shuffled away through that for a couple of hours, and if they still feel like singing when they come out of that, I'd be very surprised. It was like a thoroughly depressing experience. And then I read Jacob's piece over lunch, and it was, not the greatest way to start a day off, I have to say, but it was very educational, both. But, you know, I suppose what I'm trying to say is, by all means, press charges against these guys, but I think they need to be educated.
Education, very important. Just a slight gear change. United travelled to Barcelona on Tuesday, 1-0 down, of course. United have scored just 6 in their last 6 games. In Solskjaer's first 6 games in charge, they scored 17. Can they go to the Nou Camp and score goals?
Yes, because I don't think this Barcelona are as good as some previous Barcelonas. I don't think they'll win, but it's not as impossible a task as it might have been 4 or 5 years ago.
Alex Gotcher has asked, how much Nou Camp nostalgia should Manchester United call upon for the second leg? Get Fergie in the stands, Jesper Blomqvist to do the team talk, a full kit David May primed and ready for the post-match celebrations.
Well, I mean, is Solskjaer going to take up a seat on the bench, or is that the boss's seat?
Very good point.
Well, technically, he always had a seat on the bench.
Well, yeah, you'll sit like 5 seats along from the seat.
Yeah, slightly behind the boss's seat. I can actually see Manchester United conceivably overturning this. Nobody seems to give them a chance, but they're only 1-0 down. I think they're kind of lucky to be only 1-0 down, but I see no reason why they can't. I can certainly see them scoring, and if they do, then Barcelona, it's you know, up for grabs, as they say.
Yeah, I mean, I went to the second leg against PSG in Paris, and yes, PSG handed United those two goals, let's be honest. But, you know, they stuck in there and they took the chances when they arose. And it was interesting because before the game, I was outside, so it was the VIP area. I was just doing a bit of filming. And I saw also Alex Ferguson arrive, Patrice Evra. So they, you know, everyone was there. They were there cheering the team on. And you wonder before the game how much they would have been talking to the team, trying to lift them ahead of what was a crucial crunch game. So you just wonder if you, you know, bring Alex Ferguson along again, Evra, a couple of the other sort of old boys. You just wonder how much that might help them in what is a tough game. But yes, it is just a 1-0 deficit. I can see them scoring. I don't think they'll go through, but it is just 1-0. I mean, they overturned a 2-0 to win against PSG. A different proposition, yes, but they've done it. So I think they'll still believe. And Solskjaer will certainly have his team. Like, he'll be saying to his team, let's believe we can do it. I think that's one of the things that I would say about him. He has been able to make his players believe in the cause and you know, even if they're losing, to try to get things turned around. And that's one of the big positives I'll say about him.
Tottenham also in Champions League action later on this week, taking a 1-0 lead up to the Etihad, and they go into it off the back of a 4-0 win over Huddersfield at the weekend. Lucas Moura, the first player not called Harry Kane to score a hat-trick for Spurs since Gareth Bale got one in 2012. This is going to sound really sad, but Charlie will see exactly what I mean in a minute. But when I was watching him playing on the pitch with his little boy afterwards with the match ball, I was thinking, get down for the flash interview. Every single TV director around the world is panicking that you're not there for the super flash interview.
That was literally what I was saying in the pub, kind of, you know, A, just don't mess around with kids on a pitch. It's just I family should be in the stand, leave them there.
And it's not the end of the season.
Not the end of the season. And there's a load of journalists who all they want to do is file their copy and get in the pub to watch the half-past-five game. And every minute you're out there, you're costing them a minute.
I have to say, I applaud the bloated self-regard of my colleagues around this table. But perhaps if the journalists in question, rather than put in some banal, boring, thoroughly uninteresting quotes from Lucas Moura, which I'd imagine his post-match quotes were, they added a bit of colour involving him playing with his son on the pitch. Yeah, they wouldn't have to...
You couldn't rely on that because you'd have to go in for the manager's press conference in case the managers get there early. Lucas Moura is actually a very good talker. I spoke to him after the Rochdale game last season, and he's very... Yeah, he's very engaging. His English is very good. He's very fluent. He's a lot more interesting than a lot of players.
30% possession, one shot on target for Huddersfield. How on the beach are they already?
I mean, it was interesting in the post-match press conference because there were about three questions posed before Pochettino came out, because no one really knew what the angle was going to be if we were going to be writing about Huddersfield, because they're already relegated, rock bottom. You know, I think coming into the game, it was always going to be hard for them to get anything from that match. And they lost quite comfortably as well. I mean, they improved in the second half, certainly sort of in the last 20 minutes, say they started to actually start, you know, breaking, creating some attacks and chances at goal. But you never really thought that they were going to ever get back in that game and, you know, not even probably score consolation goals. So, yeah, they're probably thinking about the summer already.
But I mean, I think there's big problems there. I mean, obviously there's big problems since they're relegated and massively relegated. But Sievert seems to have fallen out with the three Danes, doesn't he? I mean, none of them are playing now. Not Lozal, Billing and Jurgensen. Moy didn't start on Saturday. So if he's fallen out with him as well, I mean, I guess Moy would probably leave anyway. But
Is he just going to do a complete overhaul in the summer, Jan Sievert? He looks pretty annoyed.
I mean, I know Huddersfield have had him on their radar for a long time, since even before he got the Dortmund reserve team job. So maybe they do allow him to do a massive overhaul. But he's you know, he's going into the championship season, and you know, we know how difficult the championship is. He's going into the championship season with zero credit in the bank. And if things go wrong from the start next season, everybody will just be thinking, well, this is the idiot who took us down with, you know, record low points last season. So I think that's I don't know. I mean, I don't know how you're meant to manage that situation. I guess they needed their Solskjaer figure. They needed their kind of their well-loved club legend to come in and take the flag.
Andy Booth.
Yeah, Andy Booth to come back for the last 4 months of the season to manage him to relegation.
I think that's what he gets frustrated about when you watch him post-match. He's frustrated that they're just not giving everything now. They've got nothing to lose, I think.
Yeah, but I mean, I understand that. But if you're then ruining relationships because of that, and I mean, the thing with the three Danes, I find very odd. But
Obviously, Spurs travelled to Manchester City this week in the Champions League second leg, one ahead in the tie. How do we see this one going?
I mean, it's a tough one in a lot of ways. City have a really good record against Spurs. And I said before these sort of three fixtures that Spurs would probably win the first one. If they were going to go through, they would have to win the home leg. And I think the key for Spurs is they need to be defensively solid. They need to be very, very well organised, I think. And, you know, Pochettino said before that first leg, he said, you know, we can't match them for talent in the squad, but we can match them for, you know, passion, aggression and all sort of motivation on the day. So if they can stay well composed, solid, no howlers from Hugo Lloris on the day as well, and hope to try and get an away goal, they could advance. But then again, City are very good at home. They score a lot of goals at home as well. So it could really go either way. I think City will advance because I think clearly this is a competition that they want to win. It's going to be an interesting clash. But I think they're going to have learned a lot as well from the game against Liverpool last year, where they lost their composure, I felt. Guardiola certainly did, you know, he got sent off. So I think the key for City is just to keep calm. Even if they concede an early goal, they need to keep their composure. They didn't do that last year against Liverpool at the Etihad. They can do that. I can see them advancing.
Jonathan?
Yeah, I think City probably will go through, but the away goal situation makes it, you know, for all the away goals rule is a terrible thing, an aberration, the greatest injustice ever imposed upon footballing humanity. It does make this tie fascinatingly poised. If Tottenham do get an away goal, maybe they do hold out. I can't see it being 0-0.
No. Because when Palace scored against City, I said earlier that they didn't lay a glove on them, but City were 2-0 up and Palace scored that free kick. City were visibly rattled for, you know, 3 or 4 minutes.
Well, that's the odd thing with City. For all they kind of have this sort of serene progress of, you know, just constantly winning games without seeming to stretch themselves, when something goes wrong, they are susceptible to panic. And we've seen that actually with all Guardiola sides. So
yeah, until they got number 3 against Palace, they, you know, you were thinking, crikey, they could blow this, and you know, Palace could summon an equaliser. So if Spurs can go there and score an away goal, who knows? They may panic.
Let's wrap up the rest of the Premier League action from the weekend. Fulham 2, Everton 0. Tom Kearney and our favourite Ryan Babel with the goals. Everton have just beaten Chelsea, West Ham and Arsenal in a row. And now they go on and lose to relegated Fulham. Just their fifth win of the season. Does this sum up Everton's season?
Yes. I mean, they're just massively inconsistent. And they're often inconsistent within the same games. I mean, you mentioned the Chelsea game when they were dismal first half, got an early goal in the second half and ended up playing very well. The Newcastle game when they were 2-0 up at half time, lost it 3-2. They just, you know, they blow very hot and very cold.
Southampton 3, Wolves 1, 2 Nathan Redmond goals, one from Shane Long as well. Bad news for Brighton is that their nosedive in form seems to be coinciding with Southampton's massive upsurge. I love these stats. 27 points out of a possible 54, 1.5 points per game for Ralf Hasenhüttl. That form across a whole season would see them in seventh.
Yeah, I think he's done a great job. And I think if I were a Southampton fan, I'd be really excited for next season, because, you know, he's doing this without having had a pre-season to get him to level of fitness you'd assume Hasenhüttl's football demands. You look at what he did with Hoffenheim in Germany. Southampton could do something similar. They could be seventh next season.
The celebrations post-match as well look like they're pretty comfortable and safe now. I mean, just not even that long ago at all, we were saying that they were nailed on for relegation almost.
Were we? They certainly were in trouble, but with Shane Long in this rich vein of scoring form... 2 goals in as many games, there isn't a hope. You know, they are safe. That celebration they did at the end, it I think it's a peculiarly German thing, isn't it? That the players didn't look entirely comfortable with, but, you know, doesn't matter.
It did seem a bit odd.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And Nathan Redmond's form's picked up massively since Hasenhüttl.
Yeah, he's been remarkable. He's banging them in. And apparently Nuno got the hump after this game. Some journalists asked him a question about Wolves' poor form away from home, and he just basically got up and walked out. which seems
but it's a fair out of character it's a fair for question him. But it's also a fair question about who they take points off of this season, because they've taken 12 points off the top 5 but just 7 off the bottom 5.
Yeah, I mean, beaten by Southampton, beaten twice by Huddersfield, but I mean, it's probably extremely nitpicky to poke holes in what has been a very good season for Wolves back in the Premier League. They do perform better against better quality opposition.
But I mean, the way I look at those stats is to be encouraged. I mean, this is me being positive, but I'd be encouraged by them. It's not the Wolves can't compete at this level. It's that they haven't worked out a way of beating the lesser teams at this level. So you know exactly what you have to do to improve that. And if they're able to take 12 points off a top 6, that suggests they're actually pretty good against good sides as well. So
it's an easier improvement to make, you would say. And also, I think it's quite interesting that he's being asked that. That shows the progress that Wolves have made, that he's being asked questions like that.
It seems quite obvious that they're not as comfortable in games where they are dominating possession and they prefer to play on the counter. And that's something that can be rectified.
Leicester 0, Newcastle United 1. Perez with the only goal of the game. 7th placed Leicester losing to Newcastle, who are edging closer to that magic 40-point marker. At first glance, it looked like this game didn't really matter. But actually, Leicester can get European football next season. Newcastle, pretty much safe.
Yeah, absolutely. And what a header it was from Ayoze Perez as well, who has he's found his form again, hasn't he, for Newcastle. You can see what it meant to Newcastle fans who had travelled and to that game. It was going to be a tough match for them. And Rafa Benitez has been quite worried. He's been taking it game by game. You know, he's been slightly worried about getting sucked into that relegation battle. But, I still think that third spot, the relegation spot, will go down to either Cardiff or Brighton. I think it'll be Cardiff, to be honest. But yeah, Newcastle all but safe now, I think. And a lovely header, good win. And on a Friday night as well. You know, those games are never easy, especially when you have to travel. But they got the win and, lovely scenes at the end.
Because before that game, Benitez said, you know, that Newcastle need to treat each of the remaining games as a cup final, which I thought, is that wise? Because they've lost the last 6 they've been in. But, the question now is, can they hold on to Rafa Benitez? He's been very tight-lipped, and he sort of gave a good interview after that game in which he more or less laid out his demands to Mike Ashley. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Let's ask Jonathan Wilson, can they keep hold of Rafa Benitez?
Yes, I think probably they will. I think he, for all he obviously has issues with Ashley, I think he's very happy at the club. I think he sees enormous potential there. He's obviously loved by fans. I think there's been real signs in the last 3 or 4 months of a squad coming together. Rondon, I guess Rondon is part of the issue if they can get him permanently. And if they don't get Rondon, then maybe he does walk. But Rondon's been really good this season. Perez has come back into form. You can sort of see something developing there.
The thing is, Ashley is very reluctant to sign players over the age of 25, and Rondon, I think, is getting near 30, isn't he? 28, 29?
That sounds about right. I mean, I think I saw him for the first time at Cup America in 2011, so that would make sense.
And he's valued at 15 million, so yeah, that could be a...
But he's a really good player who does exactly what Rafa needs him to do. You know, I don't think there's anybody better.
Oh, I'm not saying they shouldn't sign him. I'm just saying they might not, because Ashley will balk because he's too old.
I think he's a really unusual player that I genuinely don't think there's anybody better in the world game at playing that lone striker role. And I mean a really lone striker, when you're playing 40 yards from your nearest teammate, just running the channels, getting throw-ins, getting free kicks, holding the ball up. I think he does that better than anybody. That's what Rafa occasionally needs him to do.
Yeah, and if you think about the kind of relationship that he struck up with Ayoze Perez and even Almiron, like, they just work so well together. So to break that up would be a huge blow in terms of how well Newcastle have been in terms of attacking, in an attacking sense, in recent times.
Tonight, Watford against Arsenal, Monday Night Football. Watford's first match since that amazing FA Cup semi-final comeback. Arsenal looking to climb back into the top 4 after Chelsea were beaten on Sunday. Who's looking forward to this one?
Yeah, for Watford, this is they could take command of the Everton Cup because they go back into 7th. Have they won this with a game in hand on a lot of teams, I think? Is that right? Yes. And Arsenal, obviously, it's another test of their away form.
Away form, which has been...
dismal.
Really, really inexplicably bad. It's a hard one to call. I find Arsenal very difficult to assess, and any result of this game would not surprise me.
Yeah, it's going to be a tough game for Arsenal, but it is a key week for them to show that they have put their way sort of woes behind them. They've got that tough trip to Napoli as well in the Europa League. So if they can get a win here, that'll massively boost them with confidence. But, you know, they beat Napoli comfortably in that first leg the other day. No, it was at home. But they outplayed Napoli at times in that game. So they've got good form and they should be quite confident. But they need to show in this game that they can get a result away from home, especially ahead of that trip in the Europa League.
I mean, technically, considering their training grounds are directly adjacent to each other, it's not really that away from home, is it? They could just play, you know.
They can wave at each other over Monday, the fence, yeah, pretty much.
Monday morning or Tuesday morning on the training ground instead.
As Vishali mentioned there, Arsenal did beat Napoli 2-0 in the Europa League last Thursday. Pretty comfortable. Another racism incident, though, a video posted on social media in which a supporter can be heard racially abusing Napoli defender Kalidou Koulibaly. Arsenal have launched an investigation and have said in a statement, "We operate a zero tolerance approach and anyone behaving like this is not welcome at Arsenal and will be banned from matches." In the other two Europa League quarterfinals, Valencia travelled to Villarreal and beat them 3-1, despite it being 1-1 coming into the final minute of normal time. Benfica beat Eintracht Frankfurt 4-2. Frankfurt were down to 10 men in the 20th minute. 19-year-old João Félix got himself a hat-trick. Félix is apparently wanted by both big Manchester clubs, Real Madrid and Juventus. Benfica apparently asking for €120 million. In the Football League, in the Championship, Norwich drew 1-1 at Wigan. Norwich 7 points clear of third with just 4 games to go. Leeds beat Sheffield Wednesday 1-0 to stretch to 3 points ahead of Sheffield United, who conceded a 95th minute equaliser against Millwall. Bristol City lost 2-1 at Villa, letting Middlesbrough and Derby close the gap to the playoff places. They both won this weekend. Preston got tonked 4-1 by West Brom. I was at that game, their fourth defeat in a row. But Alex Neil has still managed to earn himself a 3-year contract after being linked to the Baggies. I spoke to him afterwards. He said that the whole situation had been bizarre and had massively affected his players, making them quite flat and boosting the West Brom players. And I'll be completely honest with you, I spoke to him after the match and I genuinely thought, oh, I think he's going to West Brom.
I mean, that's some kind of self-esteem. If you think the prospect of you leaving would depress your players and would excite the team you're going to so much that they win 4-1.
And I've been in Alex Neil's orbit on a few occasions, and I would not say he is a man who oozes charisma in any way, and if I thought he was coming along today, it wouldn't have excited me in the slightest.
But anyway, Preston were pretty awful. West Brom, decent, and look nailed on for one of the playoff spots at the moment. Still mathematically possible to finish automatic. Blackburn Rovers won just their 5th away game of the season. They're one of 2 teams in the Football League who have both no chance of promotion nor relegation. Grimsby are the other. Big win for Reading, taking them 4 points clear of the bottom three. They beat Brentford 2-1. And Ipswich, Barry, relegated. Just 4 wins in 42 games, 3 clean sheets all season, 33 goals scored.
Yeah, who could have seen that coming? Yeah, I feel sorry for Ipswich fans insofar as their club, they're one of many, many clubs in the Football League that have a chairman who doesn't seem to have the club's best interests at heart. You know, a lot of fans, you could say, "I told you so," and I did tell you so. When Mick McCarthy got sacked, you know, or sorry, he did. When Mick McCarthy left the club last season, even when he, you know, the relationship between him and the fans had disintegrated. They'd fallen out of love with each other, but he had agreed to go. And even after he agreed to go, he was still getting pelters and abuse from a significant minority of Ipswich fans. So I've very little sympathy for them. And then during the summer, they made a poor choice of manager. They tried to do things on the cheap, got in a lot of players who are League One standard, and League One is where they're going to be playing next season. So it's no huge surprise. But in a way, it might be good for them to reboot. I don't know if Johnson would agree. I'd say a season in League One, and with possibly more to come, probably hasn't done Sunderland any harm. They got to get rid of a load of expensive deadwood. I don't think Ipswich have any expensive deadwood, but they can recalibrate and see what happens. And they do have a good manager. Obviously, Norwich fans are very pleased with Agent Lambert's work.
And last time they were in the third flight, they won the league 5 years later.
Yeah.
So that will almost certainly happen again.
Are you going to bet on it? In League One, Luton's record 28-game unbeaten run came to an end at the Valley, beaten 3-1 by Charlton. Max Rushton not even here and still managing to taunt me in the giant off-licence of bottle jobs. How big will Luton's be? Is what he asks me. I'm not asking you.
Barnsley and Sunderland both playing badly at the minute. Portsmouth are probably too far behind. Absolutely fine. Yeah. I wouldn't.
I have been a Luton fan for a very long time. I also think we'll be fine, but I'm also incredibly nervous and just want it over now. But Barry Glendening and Jonathan Wilson, Sunderland 4, Coventry 5. You were there, Jonathan.
Yeah, the least thrilling 9 goals I've ever been through. No, it was just a really odd game. I mean, partly it was, I've never seen a team waste time as Coventry did. I mean, The ref added 5 minutes in the first half and 8 in the second, and he could have added 24 hours. I don't think it would have changed the result. I mean, Coventry just played very well when they actually bothered to play rather than just sort of lying about. Sunderland were dismal defensively. A lot of people blame the two centre-halves, and by the end of the game, they both lost it. But I think the 4-4-2 shape, when you're playing Max Power as your deepest lying centre midfield, doesn't work. I think there's no protection for centre-halves. Sunderland were dreadful. Lucky you only to lose by one. And this sort of inconsistency we've been shown since November is threatening to catch up with us now.
Who's the automatic spots going to, if you're including Luton as nailed on?
I think
who else?
Luton and Portsmouth, probably.
And you've got to play Portsmouth still, haven't you, 27th of April?
Yeah. I mean, if Sunderland win the last 5 games, then they're up. If they win 4 of them and draw against Portsmouth, it would take something slightly freakish for them not to go up. But after Wembley, they won the 2 away games. They seem to have a cushion. Well, they've used up that cushion now. And, they haven't let in many goals this season, but Saturday suggests big problems. McGeady coming back from injury, Catamull's on the bench on Saturday, haven't been out for a while. That will make a difference.
Yeah, Luton on 87 points, 5 points clear of second place. Barnsley both with 4 games left. Sunderland third level on 80 points with Portsmouth. They both have a game in hand, but as I said, still have to play each other on the 27th of April. Please let that be a draw.
Well, Sunderland haven't beaten Portsmouth in the last 8 meetings.
Interesting. All leagues have been really interesting this season. I've been very excited. The Championship's been fabulous. League One's been fantastic. Premier League obviously going right down to the wire. It's great. In not such good news, though, police are investigating an incident involving Joey Barton following his Fleetwood side's 4-2 loss at Barnsley at the weekend. Barnsley striker Corley Woodrow saying in a now-deleted tweet that Barton had confronted Barnsley manager Daniel Stendel and left him with blood pouring from his face. A Barnsley statement reads, "The club can confirm there was an alleged incident in the tunnel area that took place following the conclusion of today's match, which South Yorkshire Police are currently investigating." In better news, though, in League Two, Lincoln are promoted, second promotion in 3 seasons for Danny and Nikki Cowley. They said it was a combination of a lifetime's work. I've seen them this season. Obviously, Luton played them a couple of seasons ago. That they've been great.
Good.
Good for them. I just want to mention the National League as well. Ed on Twitter wanted us to note that Leighton Orient going back to the top of the National League, thanks to a late penalty, happened after James Dayton was stretchered off with a suspected broken leg and was given a red card on his stretcher after throwing his boot at the referee.
Yeah, well, I saw the video of that, expecting it to be hilarious. And he sort of chucks his boot away in frustration, presumably of, "Oh, I've broken my leg, I'm going to be out for ages." And he sort of bounces slowly towards the referee. He doesn't sort of hurl it at the referee's head. So I think it's slightly pernickety from a referee to send him off for that.
Well, Cameron McGeehan had the same thing. He was given a yellow card when he was on the floor with a broken leg when he was playing for Luton as well. I mean, it's got to be... I know the rules are the rules, but a little bit of sensibility maybe?
Yeah, I mean, that wasn't a boot hurled at the referee. It was a boot hurled in anger that bobbled slowly towards the referee. And I think there is a difference.
Ole Gunnar Solskjaer would never do that because throwing boots at people is Sir Alex Ferguson's thing.
Football corner, Barry.
Football corner, short and sweet. Two Scottish Cup semi-finals. Celtic absolutely battered Aberdeen 3-0. Aberdeen, I think, were lucky it was only three. Aberdeen had two men sent off. Their manager, Derek McInnes, was sent to the stand, and his assistant, Tony Doherty, was also sent to the stand. McInnes said afterwards he was the subject of sectarian abuse and he retaliated, and that's why he got his marching orders. And he said, you know, he's a big boy, he shouldn't react to that sort of thing, but he probably, because his team were getting such a hiding, they really didn't do themselves justice at all. So he reacted and said he'd take whatever punishment is coming his way. And in the other semi-final, Hearts swept Inverness Caledonian Thistle side 3-0. So it'll be Hearts Celtic in the final. Weirdly, the first time they've met in the Scottish Cup final since the mid-50s, I think.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which I was quite surprised by. And Celtic still on course for the treble. And Neil Lennon, I get the impression Celtic fans aren't hugely enthused by the prospect of him getting the full-time job again there, but he hasn't done a huge amount wrong. So, he was asked, well, he's constantly been asked if he thinks he's going to get the job, and he said he just doesn't know, but he clearly wants it.
Surely winning the treble would go some way to help him with that.
Well, yeah, I mean, how much of it would be down to him is questionable, but he can't do any more, can he?
No. The Women's FA Cup semi-finals were this weekend. Reading won, West Ham won after extra time. Reading took the lead through Rachel Furness. Alicia Lehmann with the equaliser. Reading missed a penalty in the second half. No more goals after extra time. West Ham went on to win the penalty shootout, which went to sudden death at Bramall Lane. So they're into their first ever Women's FA Cup final. Manchester City 1, Chelsea 0 was the other result. Magdalena Eriksson's own goal in the 92nd minute. Did you not just feel for her? So cruel.
I'll be honest, I laughed.
why doesn't that surprise
it's
me?
It's one of those, it's funny because it happened to someone else, but it wasn't so much the goal, which, you know, these things happen, but her total crestfallenness afterwards, like head in hands, oh God, what have I done? But yeah, it was very...
Of all people this season as well, Emma Hayes said afterwards, you know, she's been fantastic for Chelsea this season. For that to happen to her is you know, really, really upsetting, not under any pressure either. So it's going to be...
Yeah, and at that stage of the game, obviously, but, you know, that's life.
So Manchester City, West Ham at Wembley on the 4th of May. And that is enough for part two. We'll start part three in Spain with Sidlow. Welcome back to the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's get the latest from around Europe, starting in Spain with Sid Lowe. Hello, Sid Lowe.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Now, much changed. Barcelona held away at bottom of the table. Huesca, what happened there?
Well, precisely as you say, a very much changed Barcelona team. Obviously, Barcelona last weekend with their victory against Atletico Madrid pretty much tied up the league title, focusing on Manchester United with the second leg coming up tomorrow. And they were always likely to make changes, but they didn't just make some. They made changes all the way through the team, with the possible exception of Dembele, who's returning from an injury. I think you look at the starting 11 and you say, well, look, there's only one regular starter in there, which is the goalkeeper, Marc-Andre ter Stegen. Apart from that, it was a very, very young team, an average age of 24. I think it was three debutants, if I'm not mistaken, in that starting 11. And so it was natural, really. And after the game, Arturo Vidal was asked about it. He said, look, we were all thinking about Manchester United, not just the players who weren't here, but the players who were here as well. And so it was quite difficult to have the focus purely on that game against a team who were fighting against relegation. And actually, I suppose, in a way, the surprise, given how much was riding on it for Huesca, and given the fact that they actually performed far better than their results suggested, was that Barcelona got a draw.
Yeah, wins for Atletico Madrid and Sevilla as well. The latter moving into the final Champions League slot with a win in the Seville derby. Looks like they're coming into form just at the right time.
Yeah, they've changed managers. Pablo Marchin was sacked after they were knocked out of the Europa League, and since then Joaquin Caparrós came back. Now, there's no plan at all for Caparrós to take charge. Everybody thought that his managerial career was over, including him, although I suspect in the back of his mind he quite liked this idea. He was Sevilla's sporting director. He's the one that sacks Marchin and then effectively employs himself to take over for the final games of the season. He did this last year, took over four games last year in an emergency situation when they sacked Montella. Comes in again in an emergency situation this year. And since he's taken over, they've won four and lost one of their five games. Admittedly, the one defeat was a painful one because it was against Valencia, the other team competing for a Champions League place. But they're back in that Champions League place now, and under Caparrós have the best record of anyone in La Liga, and it was really, really big for them at the weekend. I mean, the Seville derby is always huge. The Seville derby in Easter feels even bigger yet. The Seville derby with them fighting for that fourth place is that a little bit bigger again. And with that victory, they're into the final Champions League place, and they've got a huge one at the weekend against Getafe, and it will be, I think, now a straight fight to the end of the season between Getafe, Valencia and Sevilla.
Yeah, before we let you go as well, interesting stuff about the Seville derby, but what are they saying in Spain about the Barcelona United match?
Well, I mean, I think there's a sense that Barcelona got a very, very good result in the first leg, even if the performance wasn't perhaps brilliant. Bear in mind that Barcelona's away record in Europe has been awful. They'd never won at Old Trafford before. So you know, in terms of the results, I think everybody's satisfied with it. I think they're satisfied that Barcelona are very definitely favourites in the second leg. And there is a sense that despite the fact that United probably played better than anyone anticipated, certainly in the second half when they stepped up and for 20 minutes or so took the game to Barcelona a little bit, I think there is a sense as well that the truth is that there's a big gap between these two teams. There'll be much, much more concern about Liverpool if indeed Liverpool and Barcelona get through in the semi-final. But I think there's not a huge amount of concern, which isn't to say anyone's assuming it's done. But I don't think there's a huge amount of concern about this. There's a sense that Barcelona are in a good position, and there's a sense that bottom line, Barcelona are a better team than Manchester United.
Yeah, sounds pretty much the same over here in the UK, what everyone's thinking. Thanks very much, Sid. Have a good week.
Pleasure.
And from Spain, we travel to Germany with this WhatsApp report from Archie Rintutt.
First, to the title race. Dortmund, despite that 5-0 shellacking at Bayern last week, only a point behind them before facing Mainz on Saturday. And they won 2-1. Jadon Sancho scored twice, but it was nervy come the end. 2-0 up at half-time. One of their standout performers this season, goalkeeper Roman Bürki, came to the rescue with a late triple save. But Bayern remained top after comfortably seeing off Fortuna Düsseldorf. Kingsley Coman, fresh from his fist fight in training with Robert Lewandowski during the week, scoring twice in a 4-1 win. Only twist was to goalkeeper Manuel Neuer's ankle, off injured, and such is the frequency with which that's happening, his playing days sadly might be numbered. But a lot going on in the rest of the league too, so race for the Champions League first. RB Leipzig, basically there on 58 points after a 2-0 home win over Wolfsburg. Six clear of Frankfurt, the final occupants of the Bundesliga's top four right now. But fresh from a 4-2 first leg defeat in their Europa League quarterfinal at Benfica, they were shocked 3-1 at home by Augsburg on Sunday. Steered away from trouble in their first game in charge under Martin Schmidt, former car mechanic and Yodel Club member. That meant Gladbach, in fifth, crept up to within a point of Frankfurt after a 1-0 win over last-placed Hannover. So too the bottom. Five games to go and Hannover 7 points off the relegation playoff spot, where Stuttgart flounder after a 1-0 home defeat to Leverkusen. Teenage next best thing Kai Havertz looking cool from the penalty spot, and even cooler for his restraint when Stuttgart's Santiago Ascacibar spat at him and got sent off. So Stuttgart on 21 points, still three ahead of 17th place Nuremberg, who had all the chances on Friday night to beat Schalke, nervously hovering not too far away from the relegation playoff after a 1-1 draw. Back up top, four clubs going for the second Europa League spot, Hoffenheim in sixth, the current occupants 2-0 winners over Hertha, Arsenal loanee Reece Nelson with his first goal since November to secure that. 1 point back on 46, a 7th place Werder Bremen, 2-1 winners over Freiburg, meaning they're still unbeaten in 2019 and still the only team in the league to have scored in every game this season. Next week, the ultimate test to that, a trip to Bayern. Leverkusen and Wolfsburg a point further back from Werder in 8th and 9th.
Thanks very much, Archie. And in France, second place Lille have cut the gap to the top to just 17 points with six games to go after beating PSG 5-1. I'm not going to ask Barry his thoughts on that. It's the first time Lille have beaten PSG in 7 years and PSG's worst defeat for 19 years. But they'll still win the league if they beat 15th place Nantes on Wednesday. Guingamp went ahead twice but ended up having to come from behind to draw 3-3 at Strasbourg. Dijon above them also drew and Caen below them lost. The bottom three are separated by just 2 points in Ligue 1. The bottom two go down automatically and the third from bottom will play a team from Ligue 2 in a playoff to play in next season's top flight. From there, we go to Italy and Paolo Bandini's Serie A update.
So, Juventus did not win the league this weekend, which they were fully expected to do away to Spal. Doesn't actually matter, of course. They've still got six games to get across the line, but it is a surprising result against opponents who'd only beaten Juventus once in 35 previous meetings, and that all the way back in 1957. Juve did rest all of their key players ahead of the Champions League quarterfinal second leg against Ajax, which is obviously the biggest game now of their season. They should have Blaise Matuidi back for that game. He limped out the first leg, and Emre Can, who missed the game in Amsterdam, is also expected to be available for selection, more likely to be on the bench, I suspect. The big one, though, is Giorgio Chiellini is looking like he's not going to make it back from his calf injury in time, meaning another start for Daniele Rugani at centre-back. And the other big question for Juventus is up front. Of course, Ronaldo is going to start, and we expect Federico Bernardeschi to start on the opposite flank as well. But will Max Allegri consider a role for Moise Kean, who scored Juve's goal even in defeat against Spal, has now scored in six consecutive games for club and country? The obvious player to make way for him would be Mario Mandzukic, who's yet to score even once in 2019. That would be a huge decision for Allegri to drop a veteran and a leader for a teenager. So we shall see on that one. The biggest game elsewhere in Serie A this weekend was at San Siro, where Milan beat Lazio 1-0. It was a huge result in the battle for the Champions League places. Milan had begun the game 3 points ahead, but Lazio had the game in hand, so it was described by Gennaro Gattuso as a final. I think that's probably overrating it, given that Roma and Atalanta are still very much in this race as well. But there you go. Big game, big atmosphere, and a big scuffle on the pitch at full time when Lazio's players boiled over at some refereeing decisions that had gone against them. But the headlines went to Frank Kessier and TM Bakayoko of Milan, who celebrated by parading the shirt of Lazio defender Francesco Acerbi under the curva. Acerbi had said before the game that Lazio would win and that on an individual level there was no comparison between Lazio's players and Milan's. So Bakayoko and Mekese really thought they were just returning fire with this gesture, although Acerbi himself said he'd initiated that shirt swap in order to try and make peace. Anyway, there's been much moralising about this in the press. Much more about those two players walking around with the shirt, curiously, than there was about what looked like attempted punches thrown during the aforementioned scuffle. But all players have now made peace, as is the current way, on their social media channels, with Kessie and Bakayoko apologising and Acerbi saying, enough polemics, see you on the pitch, which they will indeed in just 9 days' time when Milan and Lazio contest the second leg of their Coppa Italia semi-final.
Thanks very much, Paolo. Now, Barry, you've been keeping across the latest with John Delaney and the FAI, haven't you?
Yeah, and there's plenty to keep across. The FAI's former chief executive of 14 years turned executive vice president of a couple of months appeared, along with several of his cronies and colleagues, in front of a government select committee last week. Sort of thing that David Brailsford, you know, similar kind of grilling, or supposed to be grilling, although several of the people involved on the committee didn't seem that well prepared for it. John Delaney basically stonewalled, obfuscated, and refused to answer any of the questions he was asked about, mainly to do with this 100 grand loan he gave to the Football Association of Ireland, his own employers, a few years ago. He has all the answers as to why that money was given, what it was for, and he refused to answer any questions. I think he thought he was being a bit clever, but he's come out of it very badly. And he also sort of hung several of his colleagues out to dry by refusing to answer questions. They were asked the same questions they either couldn't answer or chose not to answer. But it was very embarrassing for the Football Association of Ireland, who are accountable to the government because they receive government funding which is now being suspended until the government gets some answers to the questions they want. So the Sunday Times, some brilliant investigative journalism by a guy called Mark Tighe, over the weekend they hammered Delaney again. They got their hands on credit card receipts and were able to reveal that in the second 6 months of 2016, while on a ludicrously large salary of 360,000 euros a year in his position as chief executive, Delaney racked up 40 grand on his FAI credit card, cash withdrawals of 6 grand, 400 euros on a purchase from a Hilfiger shop, 500 euros on 2 visits to a dry cleaners, which is quite the business to be in by the sound of things.
It's always money in laundering.
Ah, yes. 226 euros in Thomas Pink, the fancy shirt makers, 563 euros on 13 separate visits to his local pub, 109 euros from Kurt Geiger, an upmarket British footwear and accessories retailer, 91 euros from Kath Kidston, which is apparently a distinctive lifestyle brand, and a 4,474 bill for the Ritz-Carlton five-star hotel in Dubai. So these are among the more interesting purchases, all of which I'm sure had to do with very important FAI business. But over the weekend, it was revealed that John Delaney had been texting some of his mates to say that he would be stepping down from his position as executive vice president of the Football Association of Ireland. That has yet to be confirmed, but we'll find out over the next couple of days. Of course, the problem for him is he's also on the UEFA Executive Committee, and if he's no longer part of the Football Association of Ireland, he would not be able to get re-elected to the UEFA Executive Committee, so that would cost him a lot of money. But he's a man who has a very high opinion of himself, even if very few other people have a high opinion of him. And he has previously said that when questioned about his ridiculously large salary, that he could be earning far more in a position with some other company in another field of industry.
Mm-hmm. I've really enjoyed the last week following it from afar. What was that TV chat show with the big bald lad who used to be an MP calling the little fellow from Kerry with the cloth cap, calling him a leprechaun?
Yeah, there was this got a lot of I would need 2 hours to do this story justice, and sadly I've only got a few minutes. I would recommend anyone who wants to delve further into it to go to the Second Captain's podcast, Arrival. I'm happy to promote, but while Delaney appeared at this government select committee, this politician, for reasons best known to himself, called Michael Healy Ray, who basically looks like and acts like something off Father Ted, wears a flat cap at all Doyle sittings and is part of this.
Can I say his head is slightly too small to wear a flat cap effectively?
I haven't really noticed.
There's a definite mushroom effect going on there.
Okay, I'll take your word for it. But he spoke up in great favour he gave Delaney a ringing endorsement in a rambling speech that nobody was quite sure why he was making. He wasn't part of the committee, but
it was to get some goalies nets for Kerry, was what the big bald lad said.
Yeah, well, the big bald lad is a former government minister turned broadcaster. He's also a bankruptcy tourist, a failed bookie, if you don't mind. Unsuccessful at gambling. yeah. They say there's no such thing as a poor bookie. He's a bankrupt bookie. I'm not quite sure how he managed it. But he attacked this guy, Michael Healy Ray. Ivan Yates is the guy's name. And he was accused him of behaving like a leprechaun.
Well, he called it craven and leprechaun behaviour. So he's using leprechaun as an adjective, which I didn't realise you could do. But I will now be doing.
Yeah, well, Michael Healy Ray, when he speaks in a Kerry accent like this, so you could be accusing him of talking like a leprechaun, you see.
Somebody did actually ask me.
But seriously, if there's a nuclear holocaust about to happen, I think I would move to Kerry, partly because it's unlikely to get attacked, and partly because I just would find that accent funny.
Yeah, I mean, the Healy Rays are like a local political dynasty, and they basically run Kerry. There was their father. I'm not sure if he's still with us. And then there's two brothers. This guy's actually the clever one. That's the worrying thing.
Somebody actually asked me on Twitter, I'm trying to find it at the moment, whether or not we could do the entire pod in our actual accents, in regional
accents.
This
is my actual accent. This isn't put on.
Well, you've just spent a week in Sunderland. Normally when you come back after a week in Sunderland, you sound way more Mackham than usual.
In fact, you did. When I asked you about the Sunderland game, you immediately slid straight into it. Go on, do it again.
The problem is, if I do it to order, I end up sounding like Wearside Jack.
Talking of which, not that I watch Game of Thrones, but one of the other questions that was repeatedly asked on the pod was, can the two Game of Thrones enthusiasts try and sum up, without doing any spoilers, the opening episode of the new season?
I haven't seen it yet. I'm looking forward to watching it when I go home later this afternoon. And I'm frantically trying to avoid spoilers, which is more difficult than you might think.
I have seen it, and I will not tell you. I mean, if you try and talk about it, you'll inevitably spoil it. So
let's end the pod there. Why not? Thank you very much, Jonathan Wilson.
It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you, Vishali Bardwaj.
Thank you.
And Barry Glendenning, thank you.
You're welcome.
Max will be back on Thursday. Thanks for having me.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.